Hey, I'm Kelly McEvers, and Embedded is back. And we recently realized it's hard to assess a politician who has virtually no political record. But with Donald Trump, we tried anyway. And we wound up with stories and lessons from the record he does have in business and on TV. Listen on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Back in 2013, comedian Seth MacFarlane was halfway through hosting the Academy Awards when he dropped this line into the list of nominees for Best Actress.
And Amy Adams in The Master. Congratulations, you five ladies no longer have to pretend to be attracted to Harvey Weinstein.
Last week, MacFarlane tweeted, quote, "Make no mistake, the joke came from a place of loathing and anger," unquote. He apparently added it to his remarks after actress Jessica Barth told him that Harvey Weinstein had harassed her. The media mogul behind dozens of Oscar-winning hits is now expelled from the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences after a series of investigations on his history of sexual harassment alongside allegations of assault and rape. This morning, the Weinstein Company announced it is negotiating a sale to an investment firm. One line comes up again and again when you talk to industry insiders about Harvey Weinstein. "I'm not surprised." Even those who did not know about the harassment knew he was temperamental and volatile. Would it have made a difference if those who knew had helped? And when we say helped, what does that mean? Last week, we explored why sexual harassment remains such a problem. Today, we focus on the role of bystanders in combating a culture that breeds harassment. Fair warning, we will be talking very frankly about sex and harassment. Let's begin in Hollywood. Joining us from NPR West near Los Angeles is Glenn Mazzera, a writer, executive producer, and showrunner. His work includes The Shield and The Walking Dead. He's also on the board of directors for the Writers Guild of America West, where he co-chairs its inclusion and equity group. Glenn Mazzera, welcome to 1A.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what's the last week been like in Hollywood? What have people been saying about Harvey Weinstein?
I think people are saying it's about time that his reputation caught up, that people took some action. I think people are, some of the private communications I've gotten is that people feel that they're being paid attention to, that they're being believed. I think a lot of women are harassed or discriminated against and put in very uncomfortable situations, and they've been treated as if it's their problem, that they're difficult, they need to move on, they need to grow up, what did they expect? And that's unfair, and I think that people feel that they're finally being heard.
The reason that we're having you on today is largely because one of our guests from last week, Angelina Burnett, who's a writer and executive producer, basically recommended you. Here is part of what she said right as our segment was about to end in last week's program. Before we got to let you go briefly, Angelina, who do you see in Hollywood really taking the reins behind the scenes to try to stop this kind of casting couch mentality?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked this question because it gives me a chance to really laud one of my favorite people and my mentor. His name's Glenn Mazzera. He was a showrunner of The Walking Dead for a year. He's created his own stuff, Damien. He's an incredible writer and an incredible producer. And more so than any man I know in Hollywood, has started by turning inward and looking at his own unconscious bias and the ways in which he made rooms less hospitable for women, and then taking those lessons and really carrying them out into the community. And he put a statement up on Twitter today that really called on all executive producers to use this as an opportunity to make sure that the people on their staffs and on their crews are safe.
Glenn Mazzera, Angelina mentioned you started by kind of turning inward and looking at your own unconscious bias. What prompted you to do that?
Just speaking to women who were on my staff, I felt that I was not getting the most productive contributions from some of them on one particular staff. And when they brought it to my, and I spoke to them, and they said, "Watch what happens when we try to speak up in the writer's room." And I realized they were being interrupted, the men were talking over them. The men were, disparaging their pitches. It was very difficult. The climate was not one in which they could have succeeded. And what Angelina, who I'm very flattered that Angelina said all of that, that's very kind. What she's referring to is that I realized that I was complicit. I was, my ear was tuned to the male interrupter. And if a woman was speaking and a man interrupted her, I would say, well, oh, he has a point. And I had to learn or unlearn those behaviors. And so since then, what I've done is, as I've started to bring in more women into the writer's room, bring them into, hire them as directors, hire them as producers, I find there's a tremendous amount of pushback in Hollywood that studios, networks, other producers say, we just want the best. That implies an experienced male. Women are treated harshly on set. Actresses are not allowed to ask questions. People just say, why can't she just hit the mark and say her line? Whereas men asking questions are indulged. There's a double standard. People are treated differently, and I think had to argue my point to bring women onto staff, to bring the female directors in,
right?
And they always do a great job, but it's very interesting that people talk about something needs to be done, but then when you look at actually hiring people, changing the culture, there's a tremendous amount of pushback from both men and women in the system.
Carol writes, if the country were to follow the Academy's example and fire or remove all the lecherous old men from their positions, the unemployment rate would rise a couple points. Lechery is too accepted and overlooked to ever be weeded out. I wonder about that, Glenn. I mean, Harvey Weinstein has been expelled from the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, which puts on the Academy Awards. That immediately led to conversations about Roman Polanski and Bill Cosby and others. I wonder, what do you think about this message that's being sent now, particularly from the Academy, from the University of Southern California, giving Harvey Weinstein back his $5 million donation? How much, if at all, does that really help?
Well, we'll have to see. I will say that, I've seen, I worked on a show once in which there was a producer who was clearly, recasting people to bring in people, to bring in women that he was hoping to, harass or whatever.
Right.
I spoke up about that. I was eventually fired from that show.
I'm sorry, wait, Glenn, you said you were fired from a show for speaking up for a woman who you saw being harassed?
I was fired for speaking up. I was saying that, I would say that there was a climate in which powerful men create a system around them, and other men who may speak up or don't indulge that system are washed out of that system. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done. And there's a system in which people do just want to turn a blind eye. So, Harvey Weinstein is sort of an obvious one, but it's very insidious. I've spoken to women about sexual harassment, and usually, and if you look at even this situation with Weinstein, people end up thinking it's the women end up thinking they did something wrong. They feel that, shame. They feel afraid to speak up. And many men have to learn to listen to them and advocate for them and use what power they have. But ultimately, there's studios, there's networks, there are people who, or have strong corporate interests, have teams of lawyers that protect those interests. And it's very difficult. I would love to hear from some of your guests later about what are options that someone who doesn't want to go along with the system, what you end up doing is just leaving that particular job and staying away from a toxic environment. But when you have a predator like Weinstein, He carves out a territory in which he can succeed for 30 years.
Right.
So whose job is it to go in there and flush him out and expose him? Who's going to do that when he has a lot of tools to do that? And a lot of these predators create fiefdoms around themselves.
Last week, we talked about why sexual harassment is still so prevalent, and we asked to hear your stories. Before we share some of them, quick reminder, some of this is rather graphic.
Hi, Joshua. My name is Mara, and I'm calling from Richmond, Virginia.
Hi, I'm Nilima from Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Hi, I'm Steven from Colorado.
My name is Barbara. I'm from Tucson.
I'm a personal trainer, and I've worked in gyms for a very long time. And needless to say, I've been sexually harassed.
I have some issues with harassment at work.
I had my backside smacked and was told that I obviously work out, told that I was very attractive.
One day he gave me a card that said, "Roses are red, violets are blue. I want to stick my penis in you." I had no idea what to do with that at all.
The way to deal with that is mostly dealing with our own response to it.
I talk very loud. I find that this disarms men.
Fortunately, I've come across the sky, S-K-Y, sky breathing technique.
Also, I tend to gross them out. I say something so that they can feel how I feel when they make inappropriate comments.
I didn't feel comfortable saying anything because of the stigma attached to my physical stature, I guess.
I had no other job to go to. I was a dropout of high school, and this is where I worked. So I had to just deal with it.
Many thanks to those of you who are willing to share your stories. I know it's not easy to talk about that again and relive it. Glenn Mazera, before we bring in the rest of our guests, I hear these voicemails and it just makes my blood boil. But it almost makes it boil hotter that nobody for decades stopped this kind of thing. That there was no one in Hollywood on par with Harvey Weinstein or above him that had the guts to say, you know what? Enough. What is it about Hollywood that allowed this to fester? Was it just the money? Was it just that he was profitable? Is there a deeper problem? Or was this just greed at work?
I think it's all of those things. But I also think that one of the problems really affecting Hollywood, and we see now, is that there's a complete lack of professional standards. There are no models. There is no training, professional training. I was in healthcare for over a decade. And I received a lot of management training. How do I supervise somebody? What's appropriate? How do you resolve conflicts? What to do if somebody brings an issue to you? Very often when people have an HR complaint, they might bring it to HR, but immediately it seems that in my experience in Hollywood, a lot of the lawyers are then worried that the man who is being complained against is going to launch a lawsuit for defamation or wrongful termination or something. So they try to get everybody to resolve things in a way that doesn't hold people accountable. Mm-hmm. And I think we need some type of professional standards. There's just anybody can come into Hollywood, anybody works. There's people have film school degrees perhaps, but there's very little discussion. There's zero discussion about what's acceptable. So when something like this happens with Harvey, people say, oh, what do you expect? It's Hollywood, surprise, surprise. Stay away from him. Mm-hmm. And people try to just, you know, but it doesn't stop the behavior. It's about protecting yourself and removing yourself from a toxic environment and allowing that toxic environment to fester over there. That's what's happened.
Speaking of having the discussion, Abby tweeted, really pleased that 1A is having men on the show to talk about, powerful men on the show to talk about their hostile work environments and their responsibility to be alert and fix the problem. On the flip side, Leslie emailed, do you realize you just asked for a man's perspective on how women are sexually harassed? That you are two men talking about how women are harassed? Sure, you had a woman on last week, but come on. This is part of the problem. Leslie, good point. Joining us now from WGBH in Boston is Jacqueline Friedman, the founder and former executive director of Women, Action, and the Media. Her upcoming book is called Unscrewed: Women, Sex, Power, and How to Stop Letting the System Screw Us All. Jacqueline, welcome to 1A.
Happy to be with you.
Joining me here in studio is Hai Feldblum, a commissioner at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. She's been one of the EEOC's five commissioners since 2010. Hai, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And joining us from the studios of WFAE Public Radio in Charlotte, North Carolina, Tony Porter, the co-founder and CEO of A Call to Men. That's a nonprofit that deals specifically with the intersection of toxic masculinity and violence against women. Tony, glad to have you with us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Hi, Feldblum. Let me start with you. So I'm a guy. I'm at work. I see something happening to a woman on my workplace. Maybe it's just out of the corner of my eye. I'm not involved. I have no truck with this dude. I don't know this guy. I just saw it from a distance. What do I do? I really am not part of this. I just happened to see it. Under the law, from the EEOC's perspective, what are my options?
Well, under the law, you don't have to do anything. But of course, you are part of it. Because you are in the workplace. And so by not saying anything, you are in fact enabling something to happen. Now, legally, if you go to your supervisor or to that dude's supervisor and say, I just saw this happen, you know what? That supervisor now has a legal obligation to investigate what's happened, either him or herself or whoever's been given that responsibility, and then to take some action. A legal responsibility, it's not an option. The thing is, you want to make sure that you're not then retaliated against, that suddenly you don't become the object of this harassment. That's why people feel like, hey, I'm not going to deal. You know what? The employer needs to have a system, a culture, in which people who come forward, what we call an engaged bystander, is seen as having done something positive for the workplace and is supported, not harmed.
Jacqueline Friedman, what are you seeing in terms of gender equity, you know, in the media for sure, that is making a difference? Are you finding that the conversation is mostly women talking to other women about the issues women are encountering in the workplace, or are you finding more men who are willing to step up?
I wish I were. I mean, I think that there are men. Obviously, Glenn is a fantastic example, and I think everyone should follow his example, gentlemen. But it's mostly still women talking to other women. And the reality is, if women telling our stories to each other to help each other stay safe or even in public was going to change this dynamic by itself, it would have done so already. It requires an enormous amount of emotional labor from victims to come forward and sort of splay ourselves on display in public and tell our most vulnerable stories in order to try and hope to convince someone to make some change. It really takes everybody. And I think that one of the points that Glenn made earlier is important, which is if this is happening in a workplace, it's hurting the whole workplace, right? Even if you don't care. Let's say, I hope this isn't true, but let's say you feel like it's not your business, you're not that concerned if an individual woman you don't know is getting targeted. It actually hurts the workplace's ability to get the job done. There's a social phenomenon called stereotype threat, which means that if a group is part of a minority and there's a negative stereotype about them and they're cued, they're reminded of that stereotype, they're going to be more likely to live down to it, basically. And what that means in the workplace is that when women are treated as sexual objects or even just reminded through gendered jokes about gender stereotypes and things like that, they're going to perform less well on math and logic tasks and all kinds of things. It's literally hurting your team's ability to perform. So it really is everybody's problem. We just need to get to a place where everyone sees it that way.
Tony Porter, can you help us get at this idea of toxic masculinity? I think that term gets thrown around a lot and it bears definition. I mean, I guess my own conception of masculinity says, if you see a woman being threatened, jump up and do something. Like, that's the way I view myself as a man. But at what point does it become toxic?
Well, I think there's a thin line also between just masculinity and toxic masculinity. So, I mean, the term is a relatively new term, and it presents its own challenges for me as well. It lets the majority of men off the hook as identifying a collective, a small collective of men being a problem, and is moving away from what male domination looks like in general, what masculinity looks like in general, which in of itself, in many respects, is a problem. When we look at men, we're collectively, not this this extreme called toxic masculinity, and then the rest of us. I look at us as a collective, and as men collectively, we're taught to have less value in women. We're taught to view women as the property of men. We're taught to view women as objects, particularly sexual objects. Collectively, men are taught to distance themselves from the experience of women and girls in our quest to define what it means to be a man. In many respects, distancing ourselves requires us to develop a general lack of interest in the experience of women and girls. So when you listen to Glenn speaking earlier, he was speaking about having an interest in the experience of women in his workplace. Men are generally taught not to have an interest in the experience of women and girls. That's a hit on your manhood. So when we talk about toxic masculinity, we could talk about men who are doing things that we would define as breaking the law or leaning up against the edge of breaking the law. That would be that toxic group. But they can't exist without how we as men have collectively been taught to define women in general. We believe, at a call to men, that we as men, as the men we would define as good men, as righteous men, men just trying to hold it down, do what they got to do on a day-to-day basis men, actually the large majority of men, is the socialization of us that creates the fertile ground for men who we would define as toxic. Mm-hmm. We create the fertile ground for them to exist. They don't exist separate of us. They don't exist separate of us. We're part of this entire narrative, what we call living in a male-dominating society.
Brittany emailed, I think a crucial part of preventing sexual harassment in the work environment is education. I was sexually harassed verbally by a coworker in my late teens, verbally. And my boss at the time, a woman, did not take it seriously. She thought sexual harassment only involved physical contact. Not true. Glenn Mazzero, what about that? I wonder, there is an increasing number of women in higher echelon positions in Hollywood and the media. How much has the education in Hollywood fallen along gender lines? Or do you find that everyone has room to learn?
Oh, I think everybody has room to learn. At the Writers Guild, you know, we do talks around town with agencies, studios, and networks. We've done a lot of soul searching. And the issue is right now, people in Hollywood are looking at the feeder system, at the pipeline, and they see these issues of diversity and gender equity, harassment. They see all of it as we need to get more women into the system. So they identify talent and get them into the system. What they're failing to look at is that it's a hostile environment for many women, and there's a tremendous amount of bias along the way, and people get washed out of the system. So you have more and more people coming in, but you have people who can't get their second job, their third job. They may go for long periods of employment. The men continue to work relatively continuously. They develop skills, they get more experience, and the system perpetuates itself. So we really need to look at, to be responsive to women who are having trouble. I'll give you an example, quick example. Mm-hmm. If a woman is put into a writer's room, she may be there to represent the strong female perspective instead of being expected to write every character. Very often, she'll have a point of view. She's there to have that point of view. Men might be hostile to her. They might say she doesn't get the show. They'll force her off the show. And then the studios and the networks will blackball her from their other shows because they heard she was difficult in the room. Now, that woman may miss 2 or 3 years of employment. Meanwhile, there are other young women coming into, you know, new blood coming into the room. So the men get to check the box. Well, we've got a strong woman in the room.
Right.
And when I've confronted studios about this, they say, yes, we do that. And I say, what can you do to change it? And they say, well, we don't know.
Kai Fellblum, what about what Brittany Baker said, that the boss being a woman thinking that sexual harassment only involved physical contact?
Well, of course it doesn't. It includes verbal contact. It's anything that makes that woman feel unwelcome, that is against her as a woman or against a man. That is a problem. When you ask women in surveys whether they've experienced sexual harassment, 1 out of 4 say yes, 25%. But when you actually give them a list of unwelcome conduct that's sexual in nature, 40% of them say they've experienced it. So things they wouldn't have called sexual harassment. And by the way, when you add conduct that's simply disparaging of women, some of the stuff Glenn talked about, that's 60% of women. Hell, that's a problem.
Mango Fanatic tweets, in what ethical manner should a power broker conduct himself should he find himself attracted to an underling? I know it may seem obvious to say, just don't be a creep, but I do take the point. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. How do you train people in positions of power to deal with that? We'll get to that in just a moment, and we'll hear from a company that was recently named the best place to work in the United States for women. What are they doing differently that maybe Hollywood could learn from? Stay close.
Hi, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith from NPR's Planet Money podcast, a business and economics podcast for everyone, even if you don't think you like business and economics. Every week, we find stories that help make the world make a little more sense. Like, why is milk in the back of the store? How did credit reports get started? Or where does North Korea get its money? Listen to Planet Money on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Lyft, reminding listeners that they could be relaxing in a Lyft ride right now with their eyes closed, listening to Beethoven or whale sounds or a babbling brook or something else relaxing. Lyft provides rides as relaxing as the buttery smooth voice of a public radio announcer, because riding is just a more relaxing way to drive. Lyft, it matters how you get there. Download and ride today.
Let's see if we can get a little more insight from a company that was listed as the top company on a list of 100 best workplaces for women in Fortune magazine. It's a healthcare provider called Texas Health Resources, one of the largest nonprofit healthcare systems in the country. Joining us now on the line from Dallas is Michelle Kirby, the Chief People Officer for Texas Health Resources. Michelle Kirby, welcome to 1A.
Thank you so much.
What's the balance like in your company? Is it mostly men, mostly women? And what about the executive ranks?
You know, the balance is a little tipped. We're 78% female throughout the organization. And when you get into management ranks, it's more like 60-40, 60% women.
Is that kind of the crux of it, that it's a majority female company, or is there more to it than that?
I think we are a majority female company, but I certainly hope there's more to us than just sort of gender differences.
What kinds of things did Texas Health Resources do to create an environment where sexual harassment is maybe less likely, certainly not tolerated, certain programs, training, people who are on the lookout for it? Like, what are you doing that's different?
You know, I think it's, I don't know that it's rocket science for sure. And we're certainly, I don't know that we've also found the perfect nirvana of no harassment whatsoever in the workplace, but being a great place to work, we feel, is a constant journey. And so it's an unwavering commitment to listening to people and making improvements. For example, we have a campaign in the organization of "You Said, We Did." And as some of the dialogue that's already taken place so far, I mean, it is all about accountability and taking action when you hear about these, any type of harassment, whether it's gender harassment or other type of harassment. So I think it's an environment you try to create, if at all possible, an environment where people feel safe.
Was there something that happened at Texas Health Resources that started the company on this path? Was there a particular incident or an emergency that kind of prompted everybody to rethink the way they were handling harassment?
There wasn't, Joshua. It really is. It's been sort of a foundation of our culture. We created a promise slogan over a decade ago, and it's just simply individuals caring for individuals together. And that became the foundational element of which we built behaviors around that, of what it meant to be a Texas Health employee, what it means to be a Texas Health leader. And fundamental to that is a harassment-free workplace.
Now, one of the things that Heifeldblum mentioned earlier was the litigious potential for harassment to become, you know, a real legal problem. And, you know, I think that
a lot of employees know that HR in some companies is not there to be your friend. They're there to save the company from liability. What about that? What about the tone at Texas Health Resources? Is it, you know, the kind of thing where people know if you engage in this behavior, we cannot save you? Or are you, is it more about building relationship and connection between employees and accountability? How do you keep it from just feeling punitive?
You know, it's I think it's a great question, and it's one that we wrestle with all the time, so that it doesn't feel punitive. At the end of the day, we want to be able to have no regrets, and we want to be able to also build relationships with each other so that people can bring their best self to work. It's not about, you know, I've been in HR for over 30 years, and from the beginning of that, and even today, I mean, we feel like in HR that we're Switzerland. We're there to promote and to help employees, and we're there to help managers. So this isn't about protecting the organization. This is about doing the right thing, and harassment is just not acceptable.
So say I'm at work at Texas Health Resources and I see something, a male coworker talking a little too close to one of the female interns who looks upset. As an employee, what am I supposed to do and what can I expect the company to do?
As an employee, we would expect for you to notify your manager to come to HR. You have a number of different options. If you have a relationship with those employees, we'd also like for you to speak up in the moment. If you don't feel comfortable doing that, as I mentioned, you can go to your manager and to HR. Once we have, managers all have an accountability to report to human resources so that we can investigate the issue. If a manager doesn't report, then that makes them part of the problem as well. From there, we take each and every allegation of harassment to do formal investigations within the organization. And having been here 27 years with the organization, I can also tell you that we've taken action as we have needed to eliminate that harassment from the workplace. It's just not accepted.
Before I let you go, Michelle, I wonder, do you get the sense that sometimes companies make dealing with harassment unduly complicated? I mean, everything I've heard so far, it sounds like what Homeland Security says, if you see something, say something, in one form or another. Do you think that maybe this is really very simple, or is the work of building this culture really intricate and complex?
You know, I hope it's not, I hope people don't feel like it's a burden or it's complicated, but I think whenever you've got you know, when you have two people and one is saying something and another is saying something, I think that what I've often found is that sometimes the truth is in the middle. Now, when it comes to harassment, sometimes that is very clear, and we don't need to take a long time. And we have made changes within our organization in less than 24 hours in situations that are just sort of a closed book. Other cases can be a little bit stickier, and so you want to take your time and make sure that everybody gets due process and that we're looking at both sides of the issue. So creating that safe environment so that people can bring their best selves to work is what we're constantly striving for.
Michelle Kirby is the Chief People Officer for Texas Health Resources, recently named number one on Fortune magazine's list of the 100 best workplaces for women. Michelle Kirby, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you, Joshua.
Let's continue our conversation with the rest of our panel. I wonder about that training piece, particularly for executives and for supervisors to not end up doing the kind of thing that we are now talking about with Harvey Weinstein. Mango Fanatic tweeted, "In what ethical manner should a power broker conduct himself should he find himself attracted to an underling?" Tony Porter, how do you engage with men in terms of dealing with subordinates? I know it's obvious that they should not be preying on their subordinates, but how do you teach that? How do you explain that conceptually?
Well, it's not just men and their subordinates. It's really about how we engage men in respect to our experiences with women in general, to tell you the truth. We teach men, and it's a lot of what Glenn was talking about earlier, we teach men to have an interest in the experience of women and girls, because we work a lot with boys as well, outside of sexual conquest. We teach men to value the experiences and the voices of women outside of sexual conquest. So much of what we've been taught as boys to later become men is to have a limited or lack of interest in the experience of women and girls, with the exception of sexual conquest. So we have to reteach. It's unfortunate, but it's the reality. We have to reteach men how to be with and how to experience women. So it's not as simplistic as it sounds. So much of what we're talking about is equally as complex. This distancing process that we're taught as men to define what it means to be a man. You know, something as simple as boys being coached and taught that you hit like a girl. You know, that's what a coach is saying. Our work with coaches is to then say, well, what are you saying about girls? What are we teaching boys about girls? We're teaching them to have a lack of value in the experience of women and girls. Actually, the name calling that's used is teaching them to denigrate women and girls. In many respects, we're teaching men and boys to dehumanize women and girls. There's a real... You know, even misogyny, when we think about it, when we think about the entertainment industry that we're talking about, when we think about the music industry, part of the entertainment industry, so much of what we're digesting as men can easily, clearly be considered misogynistic, right? And as good men, we would deny all of that. But that is part of our socialization. That's part of our reality. And we have to reteach men, reeducate men. It's not just about... Everything that we're talking about today that's happening in the workplace mirrors what's going on in society.
Right.
Right? As men, we have such limited outrage in these experiences. Well, we're taught to distance ourselves and have a lack of interest to begin with. It makes sense why we have a limited outrage. So, yeah, we need to do what we're doing around HR and all of that, you know, in regards to how to respond to violence in the workplace or violence in society. But at the same time, we got to figure out how to get in front of it, how to prevent it in general. And there we need men, a critical mass of men, like a critical mass of men like Glenn, to really become part of the solution. How men are using their influence, how they're using their platform, what we're teaching, educating, re-educating. Because we have to re-educate around socialization.
All of
that's part of the equation.
Deborah Ortloff tweeted, Hollywood may be more intense, but still about power. Hashtag MeToo, for example, shows this is not just Hollywood. MeToo is a hashtag that's been trending that indicates that the user is sharing their story of dealing with sexual harassment. Heifeld Bloom, I know our time is short, but I did want to talk to you about sexual harassment training programs. I think any number of us have sat through probably one of those absolutely awful training videos.
So, what is sexual harassment?
Linda, you are doing a fine job here.
Oh, well, thank you, Steve.
But you know, you might try dressing a little sexier at work.
I'm sorry?
I mean, we're talking about your job here.
Thoroughly educational. What should a program for training actually consist of?
Oh, my. You know, Tony, you are right on. It is about relearning values of respect. It's not that. The training that EOC, completely new training EOC just rolled out last week called Respectful Workplaces Training, is a skill-based approach on how to learn to speak and act respectively. And it's pieces on bystander engagement. It's pieces on what's not okay. It's not about what's legally okay and not okay. It is about, although it has part of that, it's about empowering people with the skills to respond in effective ways. Joshua, you said you would have tried to come out at someone who was treating someone disrespectfully. There are different power dynamics in different workplaces. This training, Respectful Workplaces Training, is designed to give people the skills, regardless of the workplace, on how to change that workplace culture. So we have women and men, regardless of the number of women and men in the workplace, treated respectfully.
Where are you seeing the greatest potential for men who, or any kind of bystander, not just men, but for people who are beginning to wake up to this issue, who are beginning to feel convicted about being bystanders? Where do you see the greatest potential, Jacqueline, for folks to dig in first? Where is the need greatest that we can influence?
Well... First, I want to answer that listener question about the boss and the underling. My advice would be you can be attracted to someone and do nothing, right? Men need to hear that message.
There's that.
Literally do nothing. Feel attracted and do nothing. I think that what we can do is sort of twofold. One is take a look at where we have power and influence in our workplace and elsewhere among our friend group and our families, and use that sphere to influence the culture, right? Culture is Soylent Green. It's made of people. and so whatever culture you have power and influence in, and we all have some in some small circle, use that to make sure the culture treats women as fully human and as full equal participants. But the flip side of that is we need to look at where women don't have power, right? I think the unspoken part of this conversation is that the numbers are changing far too slowly in terms of women in C-suites, women in power positions, women on boards of directors. Mm-hmm. And the research is very clear. The culture really changes when there's multiple women, when you get closer to that majority or equity, equal numbers of women and men. Having one woman on a board is just a sort of tokenization. And really, as Glenn was talking about, having one woman in the writer's room can just make that one woman feel alienated and get run out. What studios can do and what we can all do is make sure that there's multiple women with multiple perspectives in every room, including halls of power. And that gets to hiring questions, right? Like, if you're not bringing in enough talented women who are qualified and great, that's your problem if you're in hiring. You're obviously not casting the search wide enough. So we need to both look at where we currently have power, and then we also need to look at how do we bring more women into power. And that's going to take men to step aside.
That's Jacqueline Friedman, the founder and former executive director of Women, Action, and the Media. Jacqueline, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks so much.
Tony Porter, the co-founder and CEO of A Call to Men. Thank you, Tony.
Thank you.
And Tony says we need more men like Glenn. Glenn Mazera, writer, executive producer, and showrunner. His work includes The Shield, The Walking Dead, and Damien on A&E. Glenn, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And Hai Feldblum, commissioner at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Hai, thank you.
Thank you.
This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.